Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This year, Vermonters are reading the graphic novel memoir March by civil rights icon John Lewis and co-author Andrew Iden. The award-winning book tells the story of Congressman Lewis's civil rights activism. The first book in the March trilogy is this year's Vermont Reads selection by the Vermont Humanities Council. The authors were in Vermont this week for a presentation about the civil rights movement, past and present. They spoke in front of a packed house at the Flynn Center in Burlington. Today on this show, we'll hear selections from their talk. Also in attendance was Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, who introduced Representative Lewis from the stage.
We're welcoming our dear friend, Congressman John Lewis. Also his co-author, his collaborator, Andrew Iden, who I understand shares my love of comic books. I mean, I can only do Batman when it comes to comic books, but they do history. And actually, that's even more important. So it's an honor to have him here. Now, the idea for this graphic memoir was first pitched by Mr. Iden when he was a 24-year-old staffer for John Lewis. It's a decade ago. But March, Book One, was a timely and critical selection for the 2019 Vermont Reads program. People like Catherine Patterson and others who are here tonight know how important that is. It shows the challenges that young John Lewis faced. Let me just speak personally for a moment. He was at the center of some of the most treasured moments I've had while serving in the Senate. I stood with him on the Capitol steps during our fight to renew the Voting Rights Act. On the Judiciary Committee as chairman, I called him as the first witness before the Judiciary Committee in a hearing about the vital purposes of that law. And I tell you, that was one hearing where every single senator listened to every single word. I consider my brother and my hero, and our nation, this generation, are blessed to have him with us. I share those memories when I walked on the floor of the United States House of Representatives where the then speaker, not the current speaker, but the then speaker tried to close it down so people couldn't speak. And I was walking across the halls, and John took me by the arm and by the hand and walked me onto the floor so I could hear the discussion. All my years in the United States Senate, I remember that, and I think how fortunate people like Peter Welch are to be able to serve with him. And when a whistleblower's complaint about actions by the president came to light, everyone stopped to listen as John Lewis spoke from the well of the House to say we have to have an impeachment inquiry. Now, you know, they may not fully appreciate their generations alive today who lived through a time when you could be barred from a hotel or a lunch counter or a polling place based on the color of your skin. As a boy, because of his color, John Lewis was not even allowed to check out a book from the library. I think of having my first library card when I was 4 years old growing up in Montpelier. That was a treasured moment. That was denied him. He's our living witness to that history, a history we can never repeat. As a regent of the Smithsonian Institution, I know how important he was as a catalyst in the creation of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. He is a moral force for good in Congress, equaled by no other. Now, he calls his work building a beloved community. This is a man who's put behind him what he has, the scars from the beatings and others. He did not descend into bitterness after those beatings, that degradation. No matter how many times he was knocked down, he came back up. He came away with an undimmed faith and hope and grace and vision. But he's been a champion for everybody. Women, LGBTQ community, students who face gun violence in their schools. I like what the historian Doug Brinkley said about him. He says he's our apostle of quiet strength. That captures John Lewis. He's a hero for our time. He'll be on stage here with Andrew Iden, and I want to ask you to please welcome my brother, Congressman John Lewis.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, my friend and my brother, Senator Leahy, for those kind words of introduction. Thank you for all that you do and for all that you will continue to do. It is good to be here also with my colleague, Peter Welch. Thank you, Peter. I'm sorry that Senator Sanders could not be here tonight. But along with Andrew Iden, we are here to see each and every one of you. Now, I didn't grow up in a big city like Burlington. As many of you well know, I grew up in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy. My father was a sharecropper, a tenant farmer, living and working on another person's land. But in 1944, when I was 4 years old, and I do remember when I was four. How many of you remember when you were four? Well, what happened to the rest of us? When I was 4 years old, my father had saved $300, and a man sold him 110 acres of land. We still own this land today. On this farm, we raise a lot of cotton and corn, lots of peanuts, hogs, cows, and chickens. Don't tell the people in Georgia that I don't eat too many of those peanuts that we raise in Georgia today. Ate so many peanuts when I was growing up. I just don't want to see no more peanuts. But growing up there, I tell you, as a little child, I was very nosy. Asked a lot of questions. Why this? Why that? I asked my mother, why? Why? My grandfather, my great-grandfather, why? I saw those signs that said white men, colored men, white women, colored women, white waiting, colored waiting, white boys, colored boys, white girls, colored girls. And I kept on asking questions. And my mother would say, boy, that's the way it is. Don't get in trouble. Don't get in the way. But one day I did hear Rosa Parks. I heard the words of Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio. The words of Dr. King and the action of Rosa Parks inspired me to find a way to get in the way, a way to get in trouble, what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. And I've been getting in trouble ever since. Because my philosophy is very simple. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have a moral obligation to assess something, to do something. To speak up and to speak out. I remember very, very well as a young child with some of my brothers and sisters and a few of my first cousins going down to the public library in the little town of Troy, Alabama. Trying to get library card, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian, that the library was for whites only and not for coloreds. I never went back to that library until July 5th, 1998, for a book signing of my first book, Walking with the Wind. And I was given a library card. Some of you may ask, why? Why? Why would you do a comic book, a graphic novel, Andrew? Or just call it a book, a little book. And Andrew came to me, and he would tell you the story, and said, Congressman, you should write a book. You tell your story. I remember reading Martin Luther King Jr.'s story, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery story. And that comic book was about, 12 pages?
16 pages.
16 pages, Andrew's correcting me. And it sold for 10 cents. That little book inspired a generation of young people to study the way of peace, the way of love, to study the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. Told us something about the teaching of Gandhi. And those of us who got involved in the sit-ins in 1960 embedded part of the essence of that book in our very soul. We start sitting in. And when we've been beaten, arrested, in jail, we didn't strike back. We didn't become bitter or hostile. And we didn't hate. For Martin Luther King Jr. would say over and over again, hate is too heavy a burden to bear. We're sitting there waiting to be served, and someone would come up and spit on us. We put a lighted cigarette out in our hair or down our backs. Pour hot water, hot coffee on us. And one day we were told if we continue to sit in, it's a black and white college student and some high school student, we'll be arrested and go to jail. Now, I had never been arrested before. I've never gone to jail for anything. So I said to myself, I have what I call an executive session with myself. If I'm going to get arrested and go to jail, I want it to look clean. I want it to look fresh. I want it to look sharp. So I wanted to get a new suit, and I couldn't afford it. So I went to a used men's store in downtown Nashville, Tennessee, and bought a suit. A vest came with it. And I tell you, you should come to my office in Washington sometime. Have a large picture of being arrested. I did look clean. I looked fresh. I did look sharp. And I was telling a group of students, young students, a few days about it. They said, no, you were more than sharp. They said, you were dripping. I never heard of it before. So that was a new one for me. You know how much I paid for the suit? I paid $5 for it. If I still had it, I probably could sell it on eBay for a lot of money. The first time I got arrested, I felt free. I felt liberated. I felt like I crossed over. So during the 60s, I was arrested 40 times. And since I've been in Congress, another 5 times. My last arrest was trying to get the Speaker of the House, not the present Speaker, but another Speaker from the other side of the aisle, to bring forth a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And more than 200 citizens and about 12 members of Congress got arrested. When I see something like what we've been doing in our country during the past few weeks and months. For we are taking little children, little babies from their mothers and fathers and placing them in cages. It makes me sick. It's not right. And history will not be kind to us as a people if we continue to let something like this happen. So march of sin in effect, when you see something that is not right, not fair, or just, you have to make a little noise. You have to get in the way and get in good trouble, necessary trouble. Just a few short years ago, when I grew up, my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandfather could not register to vote simply because of the color of his skin. There were people all across the South were asked to count the number of bubbles in a bar of soap, the number of jelly beans in a jar. There were African-American lawyers and doctors being told they could not read or write well enough to become a registered voter. We have to change that. March, book one would tell you. Book two and book three would tell you that we've been involved in a long, long struggle. People died trying to exercise the right to vote, beaten, left bloody, unconscious. On March 7, 1965, when I had all of my hair and a few pounds lighter, a group of us attempted to march from Selma to Montgomery to dramatize to the nation and to the world that people of color could not register to vote. We were beaten, left bloody, and unconscious. 600 of us left church on a Sunday afternoon and marched to the Edmund Pettus Bridge in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. I was leading the march with Jose Williams on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s staff. We get to the edge of the bridge. Jose Williams said, "John, can you swim?" I said, "No." I said, "Well, Jose, can you swim?" He said, "A little." I said, "Well, there's too much water there. We're not going to jump. We're going forward." And we continue to walk. And members of Alabama state troopers came and said, "This is unlawful march. We'll not be allowed to continue. I give you 3 minutes to disperse and return to your homes or to your church." And Jose Williams said, "Major, give us a moment to kneel and pray." Again, he said, "Troopers, advance." I said, "Major, may I have a word?" He said, "There will be no word." Again, "Troopers, advance." You saw these men putting on their gas masks. They came toward us, beating us with nightsticks and bull whips, trampling us with horses and releasing the tear gas. I was the first person to be hit. I was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick. My legs went from under me. I thought I saw death. I thought I was going down that bridge. I had a concussion on that bridge. And a group of young men took me back across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, back to a little church, Brown Chapel AME Church that we had left from. And somehow I was able to stand up. 17 of us had been hurt. They asked me to say something, and I stood up and said something like, "I don't understand it. How President Johnson can send troops to Vietnam and cannot send troops to Selma, Alabama to protect people who only desire to register to vote." The next thing I knew, I'd been admitted to the Good Samaritan Hospital, operated by a group of nuns who took care of us. The next day, Martin Luther King Jr. came to my bedside and said, "John, don't worry. I made an appeal for religious leaders to come to Selma. That following Tuesday, more than 1,000 ministers, priests, rabbis, and nuns came and marched across the bridge. That evening after the march was over, three young ministers went out to try to get something to eat. They were attacked, and one was so severely beaten by members of the Klan, he died about 3 days later at a hospital in Birmingham, Alabama. But at an attempted march, in the efforts on the part of these religious leaders, hastened today from the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, who came forth and introduced the Voting Rights Act. And as a matter of fact, he spoke to the nation that night, and he closed that speech by saying, "And we shall overcome," using the theme song of the Civil Rights Movement. The first time an American president has said it. I was sitting next to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I looked at him, tears came down his face, and we all cried a little. So when people said nothing have changed, I feel like saying, come and walk in my shoes. I will show you change. Those signs are gone, and they will not return. We come a distance, but we still have a distance to go. Today in America, there are forces trying to take us back. We've come too far, and we're not going back. We're going forward to create one America, one people, one family. In the final analysis, we all live in the same house. It doesn't matter whether we're black or white, Latino, Asian American, or Native American. We're one people. And we must learn to live together as brothers and sisters. If not, we will perish as fools. March in the final analysis is saying that we can create an American, we can create a nation at peace with itself. Where no one is left out or left behind because of their background or the color of their skin. So I think Andrew would say to each one of us, we must come and march together. There are people trying to destroy a little piece of real estate we call Earth, trying to take us back. But we all must find a way to save our country, save democracy, save our children, and create a beloved community, a beloved world. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Vermont Edition with highlights from an event earlier this week in Vermont with Georgia Congressman John Lewis and co-author Andrew Iden. Their graphic novel, March, Book 1, is the Vermont Reads selection for 2019. The two were speaking at the Flynn Center for the Performing Arts this week as part of Vermont Reads. In a moment, we'll hear about the power of young people and how March became one of the most taught graphic novels in the country.
My name is Andrew Iden, and I'm the co-author of March, and I also serve on the Congressman's staff as digital director and policy advisor. I've been on his staff for about 12 and a half years, and we've been doing these events for about six, and it never, ever gets easier. So how did I get here? Holy cow. I grew up in the Congressman's district. He's been my congressman since I was 3 years old. I'm not sure if that was for the congressman or for me being three or, I was raised by a single mom. My father was a Turkish Muslim immigrant. Yeah, who left my mother when I was 3 years old. And my mother raised me by myself, by herself. If I'm totally honest, I don't think I've ever even told the congressman this before. I've been thinking about this a lot. I'm not entirely sure my father was here legally. And I was going through my mother's papers, and one of the things I found in her diary, my mother passed away about 2 years ago, and so I've been taking care of things. And one of the things that I found in her papers was that my father was arrested while she was pregnant regarding his immigration status. Just remember what those kids end up being, okay? Yeah. But I was raised by a wonderful woman. I owe everything to my mother. She was a reader. She had books in the house constantly. We've talked a lot about library cards tonight, and I was fortunate enough that I was always welcome in the library. My mother was the kind of woman who had two library cards so that she could keep a rotating list of requests from the bestseller list to what it was, because, you know, you have a limit, right? You only get four or five per library card. That was not enough for my mother. And that's how we kept books in the house. We could never afford to buy books. But the library was our sanctuary. Later on in life, my mother joined the board of the local library. It wasn't because we had any money to give, but because my mother felt like she owed something to them. And her contribution was that she always loved plants. She loved to work in the yard. She loved to dig. She loved to get her hands dirty. And that meant I needed to, too. So we would go and we would garden the library. And then my reward when it was done was that we would go in and we would pick out a new book. And so all of my life, reading has been my escape, my reward. But when your dad leaves, and nobody quite understands why or who he was, or why your name is so hard to pronounce, and why it's different from your mom's, you start wanting to read stories about people who are doing the right thing. Stories of inspiration. Stories that give you hope. Stories of people doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. And that's how I fell into comic books. Matter of fact, my first comic book was Uncanny X-Men 317. It had the lenticular cover, which the diehard nerds know what I'm talking about. My grandmother bought it for me at a Piggly Wiggly off the spinner rack in Western North Carolina. You guys have Piggly Wiggly? I've been doing this a long time. I've never gotten a cheer for Piggly Wiggly. Y'all are my people. And that's where it started. Then my grandmother realized I liked him. She started letting me read my uncle's old comic books. And I got into the Silver Age, and I started reading them. Later on, as I got older, I started going to comic book conventions. You can tell I was super cool in school. And the one in Atlanta is called Dragon Con. Just in my defense, I got Congressman Lewis to go. Okay. And my mom, bless her heart, she let me start going by myself when I was 13 years old. And I would go down there, and she'd give me a cell phone. And back then, the cell phone was like this, right? So it was more of a backpack thing. And I got to meet all these creators. And I was so fascinated by them because here were people who were making a living simply with the power of their ideas, their ability to tell stories, their ability to convey feelings and emotions on the page. Whether with a pencil or a typewriter or a computer, they were able to make these things, and they made their living that way. And it seemed so noble to me, this idea that you could be self-reliant in that manner. And it shaped my youth. And I grew up, I got a scholarship to college, I went down not too far from here to Trinity College in Connecticut. Do you have any idea how cold it is up here? What are you doing? I was coming from Georgia. I didn't have a winter coat. What I thought was a winter coat. But it was an amazing learning opportunity for me. It's what got me into politics. Because we were just down the street from the Connecticut State Capitol. And I would go down there, and I the way my first boss described me was as a delightful rabble-rouser. And he actually offered me a job. He was a lieutenant governor at the time. He was my professor. And so my first job out of college was special assistant to lieutenant governor of Connecticut. And I started actually the day after I graduated from college, because when you're poor, there's no days off. Right? I know. And I go to my first day of work, and it's in the state capitol, and I've been interning there. I've been working on the floor of the state senate. I've been just totally amazed and loving what I'm doing, really feeling like the sense of righteous indignation that I felt watching the way my mother was treated as a single mother, that this was my opportunity to pay it forward, to help the next generation of single moms, the next generation of only children who grow up in this way. And so I go in on my first day of work, and I'm so excited. And my mother and my grandparents had been in town because of the graduation. And about 15 minutes into my first day of work, my mom shows up. Just a little knock on the door. Hello. Rolls in and checks on me, makes sure I wasn't lying. I had a job. I was fine. Says, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm the lieutenant governor." And then leaves. And so that was my that was how I started in politics. That was how I started to get here. Now, a couple years after that, I needed to get closer. My mom was getting sick. I didn't know it. And so I wanted to move closer. Mama had moved from Atlanta to Western North Carolina, to Asheville, which I've spent the last day realizing is quite similar to Burlington. And so I told my boss I was quitting. I needed to be closer to my mom. And without a job lined up, I told him I was out. And I applied for a job in Congressman Lewis's office answering his mail. I think those of you who sort of understand, the mail room is kind of down here. And but it was for John Lewis. This is my congressman since I was a kid, and I'd be able to be close to my mom and all this sort of stuff. And I applied, and I got it, and I moved down to D.C., and I remember starting and realizing what a sacred thing it is to answer John Lewis's mail. If you've read March Book 1 already, you know that John Lewis was able to meet Dr. King because he wrote him a letter. So when you're running that, when you're answering that mail, you don't know what each letter has the possibility of doing to the world. You don't want to tell or miss or somehow in any way abridge the potential future of some young person if they have the opportunity to get that response, that note that inspires them. And I did my best. And about a year later, the congressman got it was a primary challenge. It was 2008. It was the summer of hope and change. Barack Obama was sweeping through the Democratic primaries. And I'd been answering his mail about a year. And I started to really love it because it let me write in a way. Now, my English teachers would never have guessed that I would be on stage for my writing. But I loved writing those letters for the congressman. Because as a child, my mother had made me write thank you notes for everything. There's actually a postcard book out there that they've got where I wrote the essay at the beginning of it. It was the first time I'd ever gotten to tell a story of the fact that, you know, in the South, thank you notes are serious, right? If it's not within 2 weeks, heartfelt, minimum number of sentences, and a genuine connection and an acknowledgement, then you have just screwed it all up. And that was my childhood. So I felt like I was getting back in. It was like I was with my family again. These were my thank you notes. I used to write with my uncle. This was a big thing. And so I did it for a year before the congressman got this primary challenge. And he asked me to come back to Atlanta and work on it with him and be the press secretary for the campaign. And so I went back home, and I was really excited by this. And I just started to get to know the congressman, like really know him. I think all of y'all are probably a little surprised that he's got jokes. But what I've learned over the years is that that's how you survive. That's how you cope with violence and hatred and stress and trauma. You got to be able to laugh at it. And that was one of the things my mom taught me. And I think very early on, to me, that was one of the things that I felt like we really enjoyed about each other. I know that's not what you expect. But it was on that campaign that I got to see this other side. And then I got to hear stories that I never heard as a child. I grew up in Atlanta. I grew up in the heart of the civil rights movement. My mother was from Atlanta. My grandmother was from Atlanta. I had heard the story of Dr. King. I'd heard the story of Rosa Parks. I'd been to the King Center a dozen times while I was in school. But on that campaign, I heard stories from John Lewis that I had never heard before. Stories of SNCC. Stories of what the young people were capable of doing. The way that the Nashville sit-in movement was not adult-led. It was led by young people. The way SNCC was created by young people. Maladjusted, as they sometimes called them. The way the Freedom Rides were kept alive by the young people. The way the most important reforms of the March on Washington were brought about by the young people. The way the Mississippi Freedom Summer and the people risking their lives were the young people. And the way Selma happened because of the courage of one young person who stood up against his own organization who didn't want him to march. And nobody told me any of these stories. And so I'm thinking about this as coming down to the end of the campaign, and folks started talking about what they were going to do after the campaign was over. Some folks said they were going to go to the beach. Some folks said they were going to go see their parents. I said I was going to Dragon Con. And I got laughed at. But then a deep voice from the back of the room said, "Don't laugh. There's a comic book during the Civil Rights Movement. It's called Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story. And it was deeply influential." And I was like, "Say that again?" And I went home that night and I looked it up on the internet. It was amazing. It was 16 pages. Sorry, 16 pages. Cover to cover. It sold for 10 cents. And it was this beautiful 50s studio house style. It was an introduction to nonviolence, civil disobedience, Rosa Parks, Gandhi. And I wondered, where did this come from? How did this come about? And so I started thinking, why is there not a John Lewis comic book? And I went back to work the next day. And this was a different time. I think people now, we take for granted that everybody knows who John Lewis is. But back then, people didn't. And it was a big question on that campaign. Because they kept asking, "Well, what have you done for me lately?" Like, I don't think you know what he did to begin with. And I put it out there. I was like, "I think you should do a comic book." And there was this big, long, pregnant pause, right? Everybody just sort of being like, "Oh, God, there he goes again." And even the congressman was really sweet about it when I asked him. He said, "Oh, well, maybe." We've got enough elected officials in the room to know what that means. And look, I was 24. I didn't know any better. I didn't know what the rules were. And I just kept coming back and back and back. And for the better part of a month and a half, every time that question came up, how do we reach the young people? How do we teach the civil rights movement? I said, "You need to write a comic book." And finally, the congressman turned to me. And I had no intention of writing this myself. I had never written anything longer than a tweet. No, that's true, but you know what I mean. And the congressman turned around to me finally one day. I think he'd really been thinking about it. You know, that's the kind of thing that John Lewis does, where he deep thinks. He's never going to just fly off. He's going to think about it. He's really going to let it internalize. And he turned to me one day and he said, "Okay, I'll do it, but only if you write it with me." And that day changed my life. Now, it's one thing to say, "I'll do it." It's a whole nother to do it. No member of Congress had ever written a comic book before. I mean, you had people at the vanguard of it, like Senator Leahy, but Well, we were talking about the history of the civil rights movement as a comic book. This had never been attempted. And so I went back to the idea of Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story. And because I am a bit of a masochist, I came back from that campaign and I decided that the thing I needed to do was to go to school at night to get my grad degree. And so I started going to school at Georgetown to get a public policy degree. And they asked if I would write a thesis. You had to write a thesis to graduate. And they were like, what do you want to know about? And so I decided I wanted to write about the history of Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story. Again, they're like, there he goes again with the comic books. But what we found in doing that was that there was a roadmap for us for making March. That Dr. King himself had actually helped edit that comic book. That it was used to inspire some of the earliest acts of civil disobedience in the movement by doing things like we're doing here. Going, giving talks, explaining the purpose, and having the books as a takeaway so that you can internalize and reread and pass along the comics. And so we worked. We worked for months and months and years and years. Remember, we had the idea 2008. Book one comes out 2013. And we had day jobs. Congressman was a congressman, is a congressman. I was a staffer. Responsibilities. So we would work at night and on weekends. Sometimes he would fall asleep on the phone. Sometimes I would fall asleep on the phone. You'd just be talking, and then mid-sentence, you'd just hear like a snore coming in from the other. I'm just kidding, sir. You don't really snore. I know, right? And so it took us the better part of 2 years to find a publisher. Everybody said, no, that would never work. Then it took us 3 years to actually make it. And that was a crazy process. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. It was, well, this sums it up neatly. You guys have any recollection of the comic book hearings that Congress held in 1954, right? A little vaguely? Okay. So the gist of it is, Congress blamed juvenile delinquency on comic books. And the Judiciary Committee impaneled a subcommittee, it was a select committee on juvenile delinquents, which held these crazy hearings that drove most of the people in business in comics out of business. Now, part of it was because they were antagonistic, and comic people are pretty irreverent, and so when they were called to testify, they hammed it up, and Congress does not like that. And so Congress almost destroyed comics. And so we'd worked on these books. And before book one came out, Congressman Lewis decided he was going to go to the San Diego Comic-Con. And I, being a staffer, decided I was going to go out a little bit early, because you can, and because I wanted to make sure everything was okay. And the congressman had to testify in front of Senator Leahy's committee on the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. This is just after the Shelby County decision had been handed down, and parts of the Voting Rights Act had been struck down. And so I'm watching, because I got to do my staffer duty, I'm watching the hearing at the convention on a live stream, and Congressman testifies, or is about to testify, and Senator Leahy is giving this wonderful introduction, and then out of nowhere, he pulls out a copy of March Book 1 in the Judiciary Committee, the same committee. And Senator, I don't know exactly where you are, but I wish you could have seen what myself and the people, the publisher, and everybody else did when we saw that happen. It was not graceful, but it was passionate. Because us on the true nerd comic side, I mean, that was the closest thing we'd ever come to healing that wound in almost 60 years. And this is before the book even came out. Nobody knew the book was any good. I mean, Senator Leahy had read it. He knew it. But nobody else did. So the look on the staffer's face behind him when he pulls out that book, I mean, it was bug eyes. Straight bug eyes. Have I gone into an alternate dimension? What is happening here, right? And I started crying. Because here I'd been fighting for years and years, and it was almost there. And I was taking a lot of flack from my colleagues who thought it wasn't the best idea. It might not be graceful for the congressman. I mean, he's dignified and important, and comics are not. At least they thought that. And that vote of support meant so much to us. And then a few weeks later, we realized exactly how big this was going to be. And I got a phone call from a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And he said, "Man, I don't usually do this, but I got an advanced copy of your book. And I read it, and I loved it, and I gave it to my 9-year-old son. And I called because I wanted you to know that he read it. And then he went and put on his Sunday suit, and now he's marching around my house demanding equality for everyone." That's it, right? Imagine if we could instill a social consciousness in every 9-year-old in America. That's what March is about. You know, the Southern Poverty Law Center had a term. It's called the 9-word problem. They did a study about 7 years ago that looked at civil rights education standards in the United States. Most students graduate from high school only knowing 9 words about the civil rights movement. They know Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream, and that's it. And that became our mission. That became our mantra, that we were going to defeat that. And then last week, we got the results of a pretty intensive study looking at the teaching of comics, of all things, in the classroom. And they found, they looked at the 10 most taught graphic novels in America. And they found that March was the second most taught graphic novel in America. Don't tell me things can't change. Don't tell me. So, in March, we tried very hard to put specific lessons for today's youth. They need to understand their power. They need that hope that I needed when I was a 9-year-old kid, angry that my mother was mistreated as a single parent, angry at the systemic discrimination against women in our society. And in those lessons I see today, these young people are using them. They're standing up. They're fighting back. And we're trying to point them as best we can in a helpful direction, but they're finding it their own way. Now, where do I think they should start? What's my take on this? I think they got to start with student loans. Put the story this way. Imagine if they'd had student loans during the civil rights movement. Imagine if all of those young people that led the civil rights movement had, when they graduated, to pay student loan debt. John Lewis made, I think it was $10 a week as chairman of SNCC after he graduated from ABT. That's not enough money to pay your student loan debts, let alone your rent. Nobody is paying high salaries to student activists. I'm going to put it to you a different way. When John Lewis got married to his wife Lillian, the wedding announcement in the LA Times read, "Unemployed political activist John Lewis to wed." People who are ahead of their time pay a price. And we have to lift the burden of debt so that another generation is free to pay that price for us. I'm going to tell you one more story, and then I want to get to some questions. When I was in high school, I would bring my comic books with me to class. I'd read them in between classes. And once I got them caught out on my desk by my English teacher, she said, "You can't have those out right now. Those aren't real books." I tell you this story not as any form of comeuppance to the teacher. She's just doing the Lord's work and expressing the prevailing wisdom of the time. But I got to go back to my high school. And honestly, I had a fantastic discussion with her about her experiences now teaching our graphic novels in her class. It says something about the power of an idea whose time has come and the brief period in which change is possible. So to paraphrase Dr. King, there is no sound more powerful than the marching feet of a determined people. So I ask all of you, join us and march. Thank you.
This has been a special program recorded live at the Flynn Center for the Performing Arts in Burlington with Congressman John Lewis and Andrew Iden. They are co-authors of the graphic novel March. This broadcast was made possible through a collaboration with Vermont PBS, the Vermont Humanities Council, and the Flynn Center. You can find more on Congressman Lewis, including a conversation with VPR's Mitch Wortley, at vpr.org. The technical director for this special was Chris Albertine. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.